This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Wings thanks Rabble Podcast Network for carrying our programs and urges listeners to contribute to their fundraiser. Please visit rabble.ca/donate today. Today on Wings, the multi-generational struggle for Aboriginal women's rights in Canada.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In 1971, Jeanette Lavelle filed suit against a 19th-century law that violated Native women's human rights in Canada. Her daughter, Mimi Lavelle Harvard, tells the story.
My mother, when she married my father, she lost her status as a Native woman. She said it's like a magic building. You went in the church, Anishinaabe, and you came out a white woman. She got a letter from the Canadian government because she had married a non-status Indian, a non-Aboriginal. She got a letter from the government that said, congratulations, you are no longer status Indian, and a check for $12. She didn't cash that check because this was the 70s, and she realized that this was discrimination, that this was a violation of her human rights, because the same thing didn't happen to our men. If they married a non-Indigenous woman, she became status. She got a card. She had the right to live in our community, be a member of that community. Even if they divorced, even if he died, they were forever a member of our community, where our own women who speak our language, who were born in that community, were kicked out of the community. They lost their land, they lost their homes, they lost their very right to be part of our communities, to even go home and see our parents, grandparents. But as my father will always tell you, the fastest way to make sure an Anishinaabe woman does something is to tell her she can't. So we did it anyways. She went home, and they decided to fight this all the way to the Supreme Court. They won, actually, at the provincial court level. And then when it went to the Supreme Court, they lost on a technicality. One Supreme Court judge actually saying, you have to show that there's been some sort of negative effect, some sort of loss here. We all know what life is like on an Indian reserve. You should be happy that a white man would have you.
Oh,
because he
thought
you're better off. And that's actually been recorded in the history, because even though they lost at the Supreme Court, it was taken eventually to the United Nations, and when the Canadian government was shamed on the international level for their treatment of Indigenous women, for their defending their right to discriminate based on gender, it was changed. Tens of thousands of Indigenous women and their families were reinstated to their communities because one woman stood up.
Jeanette Lavelle's stand was furthered by Aboriginal women's groups across the country.
And it was at this time that they created the Native Women's Associations, because at the time when we were going to the Supreme Court, at that time, the National Indian Brotherhood, who was getting full expenses paid for fancy airplane tickets, for dinners, hotels, our women were doing raffles and bake sales, getting together in cars, you know, tires so bald, we're surprised they stayed on the road. And we would go to hotels and check in. One woman would check in, and then it was my job to sneak around the back and open the fire escape so that, you know, 15 of us would sneak in. And that's, we would have 10, 15 women to a room, because we know what it's like to operate without funding, to have to go and defend our own rights, our own case in the Supreme Court. And they had to have bake sales and brownies to get there while the men had full expenses paid. And at that time, the only one who came to stand with us was our feminist sisters. It was other women who said, this is not right, this has to stop. Well, our own chief spoke out against us. Our own chief in our community actually told my mom personally in the community that I believe in what you're doing. You know it's the right thing, and it's going to, you know, even members of his own family would be reinstated because they had been removed because of this law. But he said, but you understand that when we're out in public, when we're in Ottawa, I have to go with the party line. I can't support you. And this is what was happening with many of our women. So we formed our women's organizations because it was our sisters who stood together. It was that solidarity with other women who understood what it was like to have your own community say that don't bring this out, don't air our dirty laundry in public, because that's just going to make it worse for our men. That's going to make it worse for all Indigenous people, because you're going to add to the racism and just give people more excuses to speak against us. So we were supposed to quietly endure violation of our human rights in the interests of our community, because this was the law. Originally, some of the very first treaties were signed by women. And when the Europeans came here, they didn't want to speak to women because of their traditions, because they didn't believe women should speak, because women were property. And they would come to our communities, and at one point, the warriors were away on some hunting party, and it was only women in the community, and the elders, maybe a few little boys, and they wouldn't speak to the women. They said, no, we want to find a man, find any man. So they actually had the European leaders, the interpreter. They found some feeble little old man who couldn't go off hunting, so they put him in the front, and then the women. And the women would tell the man what to say, he would tell the interpreter who told them, and it went back and forth like this because they refused to speak to women. They refused to negotiate. And you see some of those very earliest treaties had women signing them, but they deliberately broke that by making changes in the Indian Act that said only men could serve on chief and council, men over the age of 21, to break those traditional women's circles, to break that voice, because they didn't want their women getting any bright ideas that women should have rights, that women should be equal, that women should have a say in what was on in their community. And this started to create a lot of challenges in our communities.
You're listening to Dr. Dawn Mimi Lavelle Harvard, past president of the Native Women's Association of Canada. Their project Sisters in Spirit did years of grassroots research to count the numbers of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Their funding from Status of Women Canada was cut off by Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper, yet they persevered.
When we started working together, we asked our women, what is the biggest barrier for you having a positive life for your family and your children? And we found, when we did the Breaking Free report, little small kitchen table study of women all across Ontario, 75% and as high as 95% in some of the more remote communities said it was the violence they've experienced in their homes, in their lives, in their families. And in 1996, when I was at Queen's University, one of my professors said, let's go for lunch. We went to the local community, local First Nation, we met the chief. And he says, why are you always pushing for shelters? You're trying to force a shelter down our throats here in the community. We don't need one of these women's shelters. He said, when I was growing up, when we were kids, if we stepped out of line, yeah, my dad gave us a strap. If my mom didn't listen, she back-talked him, you know, he'd give her a slap. That's just discipline. And I didn't know what to say, because I was literally dumbfounded that somebody could look at domestic abuse, at violence, as being the same as ketchup in your refrigerator. It's just something every family has. And when we go to the meeting of all of the Indigenous leadership and the leadership of Canada on how we're going to improve the lives of Indigenous people across this country, they didn't even want to put the issue of ending violence against our women on the table. They said they want to talk about real issues like land claims, economic development, education, job training. When those things were dealt with, the violence was going to magically disappear. But we knew that was wrong. So we fought to have that issue on the table. We did the research with Sisters in Spirit. We started with 500 names. Then when we were about 680, and Canada was starting to get a black eye internationally because people were starting to talk about Sisters in Spirit, starting to talk about the missing and murdered women, we were shut down. The government told us we could no longer do this work. It was the new Harper government, said that we could no longer use the word Sisters in Spirit, but the fastest way to make sure an Anishinaabe woman does something is to tell her she can't, so we did it anyways. If we had to volunteer, we volunteered, and we were up to 800. And now people were starting to listen. So the RCMP actually came out and said that we were being inflationary, that we were just, you know, spouting off these things. We didn't actually have the hard data, and they were going to prove us wrong. So they went back and they did their research through every police detachment in this country, and they did prove us wrong. They proved us wrong. It was actually 1,181, much higher than what we had. And there have been more each week since that time. And yet, while the national Aboriginal organizations were calling for a national inquiry, the premiers of every province and territory were calling for an inquiry, 3/4 of the Canadian population was calling for an inquiry, the Harper government continued to say this was not on the radar. And around the world, Canada is seen as a leader and a defender of human rights. And I actually used to watch Harper's Twitter feed, and he's talking about they're sending millions and millions of dollars overseas because saving the lives of women and children is an issue that's near and dear to his heart. Well, apparently, unless you're Indigenous women and children, because back here in Canada, he says this is not on the radar, and this is something he will forward to the people who are concerned about it. But it's a deliberate distraction and deflection. It's like my brother, who, when you have only one dessert piece left, who says, hey, look over there, while he steals it. They shine the light on human rights abuses and abuse of women in other countries to prevent people from seeing what's going on right here in our own backyards, not 5 minutes from our homes in some territories. So we decided we're not going to be quiet. We went to international human rights bodies. We went to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. We went to the Organization of American States. We went to the United Nations. And we told them what was going on, and we invited them to come to Canada, and they did. They came and they conducted their own investigation, and they said very clearly that this was a grave violation of the basic human rights of Indigenous women and girls. But we have to ask ourselves, why is this happening? And if we look at the RCMP reports, they like to say that it's because Indigenous women have high-risk lifestyles. They have these nice pie charts, and I was at a conference actually with 500 RCMP sitting in the room, and sweat running down my face because I'm standing at the front like this thinking, Lord, how did I get myself into this? But they stood up there and they presented all of their statistics, and they said, well, look, of course, for Indigenous women, they're twice as likely to have income from crime, 18% compared to 9%. But I realized if you turn that around, that means that 82% did not have income from crime. 82% were totally legitimate. They were a waitress, they were pumping gas at the local gas station, they were teachers, nurses, lawyers, students. And they said, well, Indigenous women are still more likely to be involved in the sex trade. Now they got it, right? 12% compared to 6%. But again, when you look at it, that means 88% of the women who were murdered, 88% were not. And this is a deliberate attempt to blame the victims. Somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, but worst of all, mostly somebody's mother. Almost all of the women who were murdered left behind children. And then they say, well, we know that 70% of these are caused by Indigenous men. And yes, we know that domestic homicides, domestic violence, happens through all races, all colors, all religions, all groups at about the same rate. And in fact, when they talk about an acquaintance, if you actually look into their statistics, you can see that their idea of acquaintance could be the person who pumps your gas. For the girls who are on the streets, could be the pimp who's exploiting her, could be the John who has paid for her and then threw her out the window. These are people that they are calling and murdered by somebody they knew. So you know, how does this happen? But this comes from a long tradition. Plain and simple, Indigenous women and girls are being murdered at much higher rates because they're Aboriginal and female in a country that has devalued both of those groups for generations and centuries. It started with the Vatican and their doctrine of discovery that said our people, Indigenous peoples, have no souls. Our women were given as rewards to the sailors. We actually had scalping bounties here in Canada. The British government had a royal proclamation in Nova Scotia that said they would offer 10 British pounds, sterling, for the scalp of any Indigenous man, woman, or child. And when nobody picked up on that, nobody was real excited to go out and start killing Indigenous peoples for their 10 bucks, they upped it to 50. 50 British pounds. It's actually still on the books in Nova Scotia, but they have refused to do anything about it because they said, well, we don't really enforce it anymore, so it doesn't. The illogic of government sometimes is shocking. But when women in Canada in the 20s were celebrating their right to vote, Indigenous women didn't have that right. Indigenous peoples didn't get that right until as late as the 1960s. So you can see how this kind of history, the devaluing of women in around the world, combined with the devaluing and the dehumanization of Indigenous peoples, leads to a situation where our women are particularly at risk. Situations that have unconscious effects. When a family member goes in to report their loved one missing, a police officer says, well, that's just one less prostitute on my beat. That's one less welfare check that my taxes have to go to pay for. Had a situation with the RCMP, where an RCMP officer arrested a young woman, took her to jail, came back after hours with his plain clothes, and he wanted to take her to pursue a relationship, he says. He wasn't bringing her flowers and chocolates and taking her to a movie or to go home and meet his mother. And his fellow officers, instead of saying, you know, go home, Frank, quit being so stupid, they egged him on and laughed, and then finally said, you arrested her, you can do whatever you want with her, and let him take her. And one finally had a bit of a conscience, called their supervisor who said, you better take that girl straight home. Now, mind you, nobody actually made sure. And when it was investigated, all of those officers who let him take that girl and goaded him and participated in it got nothing. The officer who took the girl out of prison was docked 7 days' pay. because apparently that's all the life of an Indigenous woman is worth in this country. And it's not just a situation with a few bad apples. When the situation came out in Val-d'Or and we heard about the police officers who were brutalizing young Indigenous women, picking them up for hitchhiking or whatever, and then demanding sexual favors, and when they refused, brutalizing these girls, it came out in Val-d'Or. But we have heard these stories, the Twilight drives out in Thunder Bay. We actually picked up a young girl just outside of Sudbury once. We thought she was drunk because she was stumbling down the side of the highway, but she was hypothermic because they had just dumped her out on the side of the road with no shoes, no jacket, no nothing. Took her to a shelter. But this has been going on. So we weren't particularly shocked. I'm appalled and I'm angry, but I wasn't shocked because we've been hearing this for a long time. And when we ask why this is happening, yes, it is about high-risk lifestyles. But this is not a choice. Our women are at risk because they're born at risk in a country where people are living in third world conditions. When you're in communities that have no clean water, communities that have no schools, no housing, no electricity, many don't even have a road into the community and no connection to the rest of the world, which is how it's been able to go on so long because nobody sees it. A flight into one of these communities, I can go to Paris 3 or 4 times for the cost of one flight to Muskrat Dam, and that's why nobody ever sees this. And when we were at the United Nations and people were calling on Canada to explain, the Harper government's bragging about the 44 shelters they have in Indigenous communities and First Nations, but nobody talks about the fact that there's 634 recognized First Nations. That means there's almost 600 communities where women have no safe place to go. 150 First Nations that have boil water advisories, many of which have had that for over 20 years. These are third world conditions in one of the richest countries in the world. And it's not about a lack of resources, because Canada is a very rich country. It was about a lack of political will. We find that, unfortunately, when many of our women, the number one reason they leave their First Nation was not for education, was not for a job, it was to escape the violence. They were escaping domestic violence and hoping to go somewhere where they would be safer. Unfortunately, many of them end up in the cities and find out it's even worse, because now you add racism to the mix. And when we talk about our single mother families, many of our Indigenous women living in the cities, 50 to 60% of Aboriginal children are living in poverty. I actually always kind of wondered about this concept of child poverty, because who do these children live with? We don't have Peter Pan communities of little lost boys living in the streets of Toronto, or London, or Peterborough. We don't have children living in poverty with moms who drive BMWs and work on Bay Street. Let's be honest, children living in poverty are living in families, primarily single parent, single mother families living in poverty. But nobody wants to talk about that because it's easier to feel sorry for children and blame the women and blame the mothers. And it's a ridiculous concept, but it continues to carry on and unfortunately has very strong impacts when we talk about child welfare. Indigenous children, the child welfare system is full of our children. There's more killed children now in the care of children's aid than there were in the residential schools at the height of the residential school system. Our children are being apprehended for neglect. They're twice as likely to be apprehended for neglect and less likely to be apprehended for physical or sexual abuse. And I can tell you how this happens. If we start to look into this, I teach in the Faculty of Education at Queen's with teacher candidates, and we teach the candidates what to look for. You know, as part of their professional duty, they have a duty to disclose that if a child comes to school with no lunch consistently, a child comes to school, this is Canada, you know, we were out there this morning, you know what it's like, child's coming to school with no gloves, no hat, no coat, no warm boots. You're supposed to call CAS because that's a sign of neglect. Your child's coming to school, they're not clean, that's a sign of neglect. They call CAS, that's poverty. That's women, that's single mothers living in poverty. I have 3 girls and I go to Dollarama every September and I buy about 20 pairs of mitts because they lose at least a pair a week. So, but if you're living on the poverty line and you have to choose between paying your rent and paying for food, you don't have money to replace a hat. You don't have money to replace gloves. You don't have money for that first winter coat, much less to replace it when your child leaves it on the bus somewhere. This is the kind of thing, and the worst tragedy of it is that the government is not doing any better when they take our kids. It's been exposed that the government is taking our kids and putting them into hotels where they are unsupervised. If I took my kids and I checked into a hotel and I left my 12-year-old in the hotel and said, okay, I'm gonna check you at curfew at 10 o'clock tonight and then I'm gonna come back tomorrow morning, I would be arrested and they would be taking those kids. But the government does that with our kids, putting them in hotels where they're right next to the traffickers, the pimps, the drugs, and the prostitution going on. So when we are outraged about that, they turn around and say, well, we said, you can't be doing that with our children, because you can't say that you don't have it in the budget, because you made the budget. You decide where the money goes. So you decided not to fund for more foster homes and put those kids in hotels instead. So now the judges and the lawyers are putting the kids in youth detention. These kids are ending up in youth jail, having no crime other than nobody who's willing or able to take care of them. And they're saying, because you didn't want us to put them in hotels. Is it any wonder we have a problem with youth suicide for Indigenous peoples when this is the reality that these kids are facing? That they're in youth jail because nobody will take care of them? The tragedy of it is, when we're talking about missing and murdered, one of the elders actually came forward once and she talked to me and she said, why do you call it missing and murdered? And in my ultimate stupidity, I said, because they're missing and they're murdered, which makes sense. And she said, no, you don't understand. She says, my car keys go missing, my wallet goes missing. She said, my eyeglasses go missing several times a day. She said, people don't just get misplaced. People don't just go missing. They're stolen. They're being stolen from our families and our communities. They're being stolen from our nations. And we think that this is something that happens in inner cities, or we think that this is something that is happening in foreign countries where girls are being stolen and put into containers and sold into slavery. But this is happening right here in our own backyard. 95% of the victims of human trafficking in Canada are Canadian girls, and an overwhelming majority of those are Indigenous girls. A girl can bring in over $200,000 a year for her pimp if she's being sold on the street corner. That is one of the best economic, and it is the safest crime out there for the pimp, because he's not in any danger. She's the one standing on the street corner. If he actually went and robbed a Max Milk for a couple of packs of smokes and whatever they got in the till, he's actually likely going to get shot and or arrested and caught on camera. But when he's making $200,000 a year off of one of our girls, she's the one who's out on the street corner. She's the one who's gonna get shot. She's the one who's gonna get brutalized. And they're safe. So it's an extremely lucrative trade. And all of the arguments about sex trade, and I've heard them all, and I apologize if I offend anybody, but I'm gonna say it anyways. It's a ridiculous argument. It's a red herring to distract from the reality that all of the Indigenous women that we have worked with started, were put out on the streets, were recruited, at the average age of 13. And I'm telling you, I know my math skills are bad, but even my math skills tells me that that means for every girl who was 14 or 15, how many were 11 or 12 to make 13 the average? Far too many. And that is not a grown woman making a choice. That is a child that is being exploited. It's child abuse. Our girls are being recruited. Our girls are being approached as young as 8 years old, walking home from school. This is the reality of what's going on. And that's why it's so important that we talk about the child welfare and that we have honest conversations about what sex trafficking means and not get caught up in abstract feminist arguments, which are great arguments, but it's an example of how a feminist argument taken to an illogical extreme actually hurts the very women that we're supposed to be supporting. We've seen in Thunder Bay where our women are being taken into ships and they never come back. And again, these are girls, these are children, because the easiest way to evade the law is to just go to a different jurisdiction. Because the minute they pull out of harbor, they're into international waters. And there's days when I don't want to do this job anymore. And actually, I step down as president of the Native Women's Association because it's just too hard. But then I remind myself that we got rid of Stephen Harper and now have a Liberal government. But it is 2016 and feminism is not a dirty word. And I would very much like to put myself out of work and see a day where our girls can go to the corner store for a Pepsi or a pack of smokes and not be in danger. In fact, as I was doing this, in a typical mom moment of motherhood, I'm driving to Charlottetown because I had promised my girls we would have a road trip. And I now have to go to Charlottetown, we have to speak to the premiers, so I'm trying to do the classic mom thing where I'm, you know, on the CBC radio while I'm driving my minivan across the country, a whole bunch of little kids, And then, so I'm trying to sound all professional on the radio, so I'm like, okay, if this call is coming, you guys all need to, like, shh, just not one word, or I'm gonna, you know, this trip is over, and we're all going home, if you can get to not one peep while we're driving. Because, you know, mommy's got to do this. Okay, so they're sitting there with these big owl eyes, watching, they're listening real quiet. And now I'm trying to be all professional, right? Yes, you know, we're talking about the over 800 missing and murdered women, and you're talking about... And at the end of the call, I hang up, and I'm like, okay, we hit it. And a dead silence. I'm thinking, uh-oh. And all of a sudden, my middle child, she was about 10 at the time, she says, what does all of this mean? She says, mommy, we're Aboriginal, right? And I said, yes. And she says, I'm a girl, right? Obviously. And I could see the minute her little brain made the connection. And she looks up at me and she says, mommy, does that mean I'm in danger? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to say, no, absolutely not. I will protect you. There's no way anything will happen to you. But I realized if anything I've told you is true, I can't say that. Yeah. That's a promise that I can't make. Because in this country, young Indigenous girls are endangered. And that's why it's important that we do this. That's why it's important that we all stand up and stand united, because as soon as one group of women is exploited, we're all at risk. As soon as any woman is brutalized, we're all at risk. And that's why there's a tradition, actually, with, I was in South America and I was wearing this hummingbird skirt. And this woman came and says, oh, are you, you know, like, that is your spirit animal? And I said, no, it actually, I just really like the skirt because it doesn't wrinkle. And it's a stretchy waistband, which is great for banquets and traveling. And she says, no, there's a traditional teaching about the hummingbird among our people, that there was this great fire. You know, the people had fled and all the animals were standing around. And they're saying, you know, well, the lion should go in there and roar and blow out the fire. The elephant should go and put water on the fire. The eagle should come and use his great wings to blow out the fire. And, well, they're all arguing over what somebody else should be doing. Somebody else who is stronger, who should be putting out this fire. There was this tiny little hummingbird who was whipping back and forth to the river and whipping back to the fire and then whipping back and forth. It's like his little wings are being singed and all the other members start laughing uproariously, mm-hmm. saying, hummingbird, what do you think you're doing? And that little hummingbird, without even missing a beat, he was picking up one drop at a time and dropping it on that fire. Without missing a beat, said, I'm doing the best that I can. And that fire was put out because of thousands, one drop at a time, becomes a rainstorm, becomes a flood that can put out the fires of racism and sexism and oppression. That is the strength of women. Our strength is not the power that you come and bang your fist on the table and I demand this and that. The power of women is that power of water, life givers, where water can put out those fires. Water can change the shape of even the hardest rock by being persistent. Those waves crashing on the shore on Manitoulin Island for thousands of years can wear away the biggest mountains and the hardest rock, and that is our power as women. And I am truly grateful to be able to be here in a room full of such strong women, because if one woman can make a difference, imagine the difference that standing together we can all make. Thank you.
Dr. Dawn Mimi Lavelle Harvard, past president of the Native Women's Association of Canada, spoke in Toronto October 21st, 2016, to the Motherhood Initiative for Research and Community Involvement. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, and please like our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thank you to those who support Wings, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughan, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. Reporting for Wings, I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.